Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Today, with spring break winding down, and so with many of our students thinking perhaps reluctantly about heading back to class on Monday, we feature a well-informed and in-depth discussion on going to college in America, what it means and what it should mean. Our guest is Professor Andrew Delbanco of Columbia University, whose new book, just out from Princeton University Press, is called College: What It Was, Is, and Should Be. Professor Delbanco spoke here at the University of Tulsa back in September on the topic of what is college for. He participated in a Studio Tulsa interview while he was here on the TU campus, and we're listening back to that interview on today's show. Andrew Delbanco is the Mendelson Family Chair of American Studies and the Julian Clarence Levy Professor in the Humanities at Columbia University. His many books include Melville, His World and Work, which won the Lionel Trilling Award and was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize in Biography. Delbanco is a recipient of the 2011 National Humanities Medal, and he's been named by Time Magazine as America's Best Social Critic. He's written for The New Republic, The New York Review of Books, and other leading journals on America's literary, cultural, and religious history. And in this moment, when colleges and universities are becoming more and more commercialized, that is, when more and more people see getting a higher education degree as simply a means to a higher salary, a certain job, or a certain set of credentials, Delbanco, on the contrary, in this new book, argues that college should be more closely aligned with its original purpose, with its classical definition, that is, college should be about students finding themselves. Again, Andrew Delbanco is our guest today. His new book is College: What It Was, Is, and Should Be, as we'll hear at the beginning of the interview, which again was done with Rich Fisher back in September. The ideas in this new book originally grew out of a series of lectures that Delbanco gave at Princeton.
Andrew Delbanco, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Glad to be here.
In your lectures that you gave at Princeton a few years ago, you asked the audience to compare the university of 1900 with the university of today. You said, now compare that to an auto factory around 1900 and today. Very different places, but the university looks amazingly the same. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, you know, I picked up that comparison from a statement made by a significant academic who presented that comparison as a complaint. That is, he thought, look, if you go to the modern automobile factory, you're going to find that the technology is different, the way that we make cars, the cars themselves have advanced, whereas if you go into the university classroom, it's going to look pretty much the same. And it struck me there was a certain irony there, because not too long after he said that, all of our auto companies went belly up except for Ford. And they were only saved by the Fed's intervening and so on. There's also something quite misleading about the statement, because he said the classroom would look the same, whereas, in fact, in 1900, you would probably have not seen any women unless you were at a women's college.
Probably no minorities.
No minorities, exactly. Uh-huh. And very few international students, as we're seeing more of today. But the basic point he was making is a fair one, which is that the technology, if that's what you want to call it, of teaching and learning hasn't really changed, not only not since 1900, but not since Socrates. We have lectures, we have discussions, and we have tutorials. And that's about it, unless you take seriously the new technologies that are beginning to make their way into the classroom. The point that I wanted to make, and that the book is in part about, is that I think that in some measure this is a good thing, because as the world around us evolves rapidly in a bewildering way and the rhythm of life changes, maybe there's a place for a space that is the same as it's always been, where there's time for reflection, where there's individual human interaction over enduring questions. So I'm actually sort of interested in defending the college and university as it used to be, to some degree. There's got to be change, there's got to be evolution, but let's not throw away the good stuff just for the sake of novelty.
There's also an interesting sort of side point in that statement, too. It's the idea that really every aspect of our modern life sort of points out about the university is the vocational and economic reasons for going to college as opposed to learning.
Right. Well, universities are often described as great economic drivers, and they are. I mean, they are centers of research. They exist increasingly in partnerships with government and with corporations. And much of that activity is very beneficial for all of us. I mean, there's a a big recent book called The Great American Research University that has a list that goes on for about 3 pages of everything from the seatbelts in your car to the pharmaceuticals in your medicine cabinet that we wouldn't have except for the university. And I'm not interested in disrespecting all of that, but I do fear that a certain commercial ethos is infiltrating the atmosphere of the university, an attitude that if you can't count it, it doesn't exist. If you can't see the profit potential in it, it's not worth pursuing. And that's dangerous in the world of research in one way, because we want to keep a space for pure research, for research for its own sake. You never know what the great scientist is going to come up with inside his head or inside his laboratory, and you don't want him or her constrained by what the funding agency wants him or her to do. But it also, I mean, in a way, it's, I think, an even greater danger when it infiltrates the teaching function of the university. Because I don't think we want to think of our colleges and universities as simply preparing economic actors, people who can succeed in the marketplace, though that's an important function, and we don't want our students to leave without any job prospects, of course. But the American college, which is what I'm really writing about, has always been for something more than that. It's always been a place where young people have the opportunity, to use the standard phrase, to find themselves, to discover what their passion is, to explore subjects that they might never have dreamt of exploring by taking an elective course or, you know, following a roommate to a favorite professor and giving that a try. And not only in the classroom, but also outside the classroom, in their relations with their peers, in their community work, to give themselves a chance to grow. And the whole thing about growth at that age is that you don't know or you shouldn't know where it's going to take you.
That's a wonderful world that you outline. I know from hearing from a lot of students that vocational, that economic argument is paramount. It's probably drummed into them from birth by, you know, a number of generations, that college is a place where you go to make your mark in the world, where you learn your trade or your craft that is going to take you through your adult life.
Right.
How much of that vision of, I'm going to take this elective because I want to learn more about this, or that professor is a great professor, he's a spellbinding speaker, I want to just hear him, and I want to take that class.
Right.
How often does that exist in this 21st century life, which is so geared about economy?
Yeah, well, you put your finger on a very fundamental question, and you know there's a paradox here, because one of the great achievements of American higher education in the 20th century was the democratization of college. I mean, college used to be reserved for the privileged elite. A very small percentage of the college-age population actually went to college 100 years ago, 2%, 3%, depending on what statistics you consult. And most of the people who went to college, first of all, they were almost all males, came from comfortable families, and they could afford to do the kind of thing that I'm talking about because they didn't have to worry about what was coming after college. And as we democratized the opportunity to go to college, which was a tremendous achievement and I think one of the explanations for why America became the dominant country in the world in the 20th century, because we had the best educated population by far.
Yeah, the GI Bill utterly transformed. I mean, people don't realize how important that transformed our society.
Right. But it started before the GI Bill. The land grant, creation of the land grant universities in the late 19th century, and the rise of a magnificent public university system, and then the GI Bill, yes, in 46, and then the California Plan in the 50s, where you had community colleges, state colleges, and research universities, and students with talent could move from the one to the next to the next. So the commitment was to democratizing higher education. So now we have a different population in our colleges, and quite understandably, many of our students who are on financial aid or who have been taking out loans to go through college are very concerned, as are their parents, with what they're going to do next, and they want to make sure they get, as we sometimes hear said, a marketable credential. I'm not, you know, going to sit up on my high stool or stand on my pedestal or whatever and wag my finger in disapproval at people who are concerned about how to make a living. You know, that's a legitimate concern. But I do think that our colleges, therefore, in the face of this pressure and this imperative, have a bigger responsibility than ever to make sure that they provide opportunities for their students to take a breath, look around, and give themselves a chance to become educated citizens in a broader sense rather than pre-professional specialists. And that's a struggle. It's always going to be a struggle in every institution. It's very hard to get the right balance, but I feel like we got to keep trying.
You mentioned the fact that, you know, all these improvements that democratize the college experience. Do you see any sense that we're moving back away from that?
I do, and this is very troubling. I mean, you see it really at every level. In the most expensive elite private colleges, despite their enormous endowments and very generous commitments to financial aid that have developed over the last half century or so, there is some evidence that financial aid, that there's a retrenchment setting in. And it's actually very disappointing to see that even in the boom years before the recession of 2008, the number of low-income students in the wealthiest colleges was, by and large, extremely small, with a few exceptions. The public universities are, of course, becoming more expensive to attend because public support through the state legislatures is declining. You have great public universities like the University of Virginia, which actually only get less than 10% of their revenue from the public treasury, and they get the rest of it from tuition from out-of-state students and from private donations. So the public universities are becoming more expensive. The community colleges are overcrowded with people trying to get a skill to find a place in this terrible job market. And the evidence is that it's getting harder rather than easier for low-income students to go to college. And I think we have to be very, very concerned about that, because that really was the mark of our commitment as a society to be a society of equal opportunity in the 20th century. We don't want to see the 21st century going back to the days when only the rich could go to college.
You know, in the days of the draft, the military was one of the great class erasers where, you know, certainly officers and enlisted, but still, you're going to meet people of all different types in the military. Of course, we've been without the draft for a long time. Universities, as they democratized, sort of filled a lot of that function.
Absolutely.
And a lot of times in the elite universities now, you've gone back to, again, a very homogenous group of super high achievers, and you don't have that sort of social cohesion across class and across differences in our country. And I wonder if you think about that?
I do think about it, and, you know, I'm fortunate to teach on a campus at Columbia, New York, where we have an undergraduate college that looks like any other highly selective private undergraduate college. But we also have an undergraduate division called General Studies, which admits students from different backgrounds who've been out of college for a while. And we actually have a fairly list of, surprising to some people who wouldn't think this would be the case in the middle of New York City, but we actually have a fairly significant student population of military veterans. And those young men and women bring something of inestimable value to the classes that they're in. And I've had a few of them in some of my classes. And, you know, they have an experience which their 18 and 19-year-old classmates can't even begin to imagine. And maybe in a big lecture on nuclear physics, when everybody's taking notes, you don't sense the presence of people unlike yourselves so much. But in a class on history or philosophy or literature, when people start to speak up, they inevitably speak from their own experience. And it's hugely valuable to have people in the same room with different kinds of experience.
My guest today is Andrew Delbenko. He's the Director of American Studies, a program at Columbia University. And he's author of College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be. And I know you can go on a bit on what college was. What's the big differences between what college used to be, what it is now, and maybe the differences of what you'd like to see changed about it in the ideal world?
Well,
big question.
You know, this is the paradox I try to put my arms around and express in this book. I don't want to come across as a, you know, oh, the world used to be great and we've all gone to hell in a handbasket, and if we could only get back the way it used to be. There's a lot about the old world we don't want to get back. We don't want to get back the self-satisfied elitism. We don't want to get back the open misogyny and open racism and open anti-Semitism. We don't want to get back the faculty member who had no interest in the student's point of view. So there are a lot of things from the past that we're well rid of. But some of the very basic fundamental ideas about what college was, and I spoke about this here at the University of Tulsa, that college was an outgrowth of actually of the idea of a certain kind of church. That is where a basic equality in the sense of the equal value of all the members of the community was assumed, that everyone had something to offer to everyone else was assumed, that a college was a place where students were expected to learn not only from their professors but from each other. Those principles, it seems to me, are timeless, and we don't want to lose them. Now, there are some people who say that the business model of the college is broken, that the cost has gotten too high, the model of a relatively small number of students sitting in a room with a relatively well-paid faculty member is just not going to cut it. So we got to go to technology, and we've got to deliver the lecture over the web, or we've got to have some kind of interactive distance learning. And I'm sure that's coming. It's already here, and a lot of institutions, notably the for-profit institutions, are taking advantage of those opportunities. I worry very much that those fundamental principles of what a college should be will get lost in that transition. So people smarter than I am, who know more about technology than I do, are going to have to figure out some way to preserve the essence while moving us into the 21st century. I hope they will.
You talked about there was three fundamental views of what college is and should be today. One is obviously the vocational economic argument. It's why parents scrimp and save. They want to send their kids to college so they'll be able to make their way in the world.
Exactly.
The second is this idea of what you say is becoming a useful citizen of the world.
Right.
And, you know, you don't have to look further in today's headlines to see there are really very different worldviews. And depending on your own education and where you come on, you know, one doesn't make any sense to you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was at dinner last night with some wonderful faculty members here, and one of them pointed out that the media world that we now live in is very different from what I was used to as a child and a young adult. That is, everybody seems to just tune in to get the point of view that they already agree with, right? You believe in Fox News, you listen to Fox News. You believe in public broadcasting, you listen to public broadcasting, though I think they try a little harder than Fox to give a balanced point of view. That's no way to run a society. If everybody just gets into an entrenched position and cheers on the people on their side and demonizes the people on the other side, that's where we seem to be headed. That's why we've got this gridlock situation where one party will say about the other party that they're un-American and they're unpatriotic because they have a different view of what's a fair taxation system, or a different view of whether the deficit is more important than a job stimulus bill or whatever it may be. We need to have a society where people are willing to listen to each other respectfully and air their differences in a civil manner and learn to come together and agree to disagree. One of the most important places where that can happen is in a college. That's what's supposed to happen in a good classroom. Professor is not supposed to indoctrinate the students. He or she is supposed to present ideas and arguments and then invite debate, pushback, skepticism, whatever it may be. And students in a small class are supposed to listen to each other and learn the difference between an opinion and an argument. So I like to talk about college as a sort of laboratory or rehearsal for democracy. And if we lose that institution, we'll be even further from achieving that democratic civility than we are now.
I think you've referred to it as helping students develop a crap meter.
A crap detector, yeah.
Crap detector, yeah.
Right. Well, that's not my phrase. That came from someone named Neil Postman, who I think quoted it from Ernest Hemingway, actually, who said that a good writer needs to have a good crap detector so they know, you know, when they're writing just for the sake of hearing the sound of the words, they should get rid of it. That's right. I mean, I think a student, you know, we give this degree to the student, a BA or a BS or whatever it is, or an AA if they go to a two-year college. What does it mean? What does it signify? Well, it should signify competence in their major, and certainly that's important. But I think it should also signify that, you know, I'm a person who's actually done some thinking. I'm a person that, you know, you're not going to convince me that you're right because of the way you look or sound or because you appeal to my personal interests. You know, you actually have to make an argument that can stand up to scrutiny if I'm going to be on your team. That's the kind of college graduate that we want to have, whether the argument is about the construction of the bridge or the tunnel the advisability of a new vaccine, or the argument is about citizenship rights or immigration policy or whatever it may be. We need thoughtful people.
Mm-hmm. The third reason for the university, I think this is really interesting. You said it was an alumnus of Columbia who basically said it helped me develop an appreciation for the good things in life.
Right. Well, that's the hardest one to express, so I was grateful to that alum that he stood up and expressed it after one of my lectures. And I've been going on, and he said, listen, that was all very nice, but you missed the main point. I said, so what's the main point? He said, college enabled me to enjoy life. And by that, he didn't mean it gave me the credential I needed to get the well-paying job and get the big house with the pool and the summer house and all that. That's not what he meant. He meant it enabled me to live in the world as a more sensitive and responsive person, to have an appreciation for literature, for music, for why ideas matter, for the incredible artistic achievements of human civilization, not just our own, but all human civilizations, so that he can travel with a greater sense of alertness. He can walk into a museum and have some idea how to look at a picture. And so, you know, every day of his life, he wakes up as a curious person. And I'm sure that he had a lot of that impulse to begin with, but college helped him to develop it and it encouraged it. And I think that's what a good college should do.
The idea of being the curious person. So even if you don't know about something, you can always have that ability and the curiosity to learn about something new.
Exactly, exactly. That's indispensable, particularly since there's so much to learn about now. You got to have that. Otherwise, you crawl into your little cubbyhole and just, you know, live in the world that you're comfortable in.
You know, but that gets back to that question earlier. We were talking about, you know, whether you take the course from the great professor, even though it's not related to your major or the elective. How often do you think today's college students, with that emphasis on the cost of where they're going and two, the you know, just that whole economics overwhelming sort of you've got to go to college and get a good job sort of mentality, how often do you think students are taking the time to find out about the good things in life that they're going to enjoy later?
Well, you know, there's a premise behind your question, which is a fair one, which is that it's always up to the student to make the decision. And the truth is that's generally true. That is to say, most colleges have very few requirements, except within the major. I actually come from a college where we do have some rather stringent requirements. Students have no choice. They have to spend a year reading literary classics, a year studying political philosophy, a semester in art, a semester in music, a semester in science. That's very unusual, and I don't think my colleagues and I should be particularly proud of ourselves because this was invented almost 100 years ago, and it's really the alumni who keep it going, not the faculty so much. But I think that colleges should be a little more aggressive in telling their students that they want them to do this. I think that when students arrive at college, they should be told that we expect you to branch out. We're going to make it possible for you by offering certain courses that are designed for non-specialists. You can choose perhaps among several, but you got to take some because, yes, you got to specialize. You got to get that skill, but you're going to be here for 4 years, so you can take a little time to catch your breath. You do not want to have students regard all this sort of thing as a, quote, waste of time.
True.
That's something I hate to hear from students, you know, that if it's not of practical value to what I'm going to do later on, it's a waste of time. That's a very narrow way of thinking about life. And when they're 50, 60, 70 years old, and all they can think about is what they're doing in the office that day, they're going to have a problem. You know, I have a colleague who puts it very nicely. He says, now that people are living a longer time in many cases, and the way she puts it is, you want the inside of your head to be an interesting place to spend the rest of your life.
That's a good line. I like that. My guest today is Andrew Delbanco. He's the Director of American Studies Program at Columbia University, writes for the New York Review of Books, a number of other journals. His most recent I guess, specialty book would be Melville, his world and work, and he's also the author of the forthcoming book, College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be. Well, you know, the Melville was a very highly regarded book that came out. Are you at work on another book on sort of your academic specialty as opposed to the educational?
Well, I kind of go back and forth. I mean, this the Melville book, depending on how you count it, really took me 20 years. I mean,
wow.
20 years of teaching and thinking about it before I felt I could sit down and write.
Is that something particular about Melville? Or?
Well, that's another conversation. But, you know, he's just one of these artists that even though I'm very familiar with his work by now, every time I go back to it, it just blows me away. So I felt that this was somebody I wanted to try to understand, and I wanted to try to situate him in his own time and context. So that was a great, thrilling thing to do.
One last question about the new book. In your mind, is there one change colleges should be thinking about from, again, these traditions that have lasted 100, 200, 300 years? But is there a change that we should be thinking about for the future to make the college a better experience for today's students?
Well, you know, I don't have a good soundbite-ish answer to that. It's a fair question, but I don't have. I would say that in all aspects of life, I generally prefer transparency, whether it's a doctor-patient relationship or the parent-child relationship. And so I find that colleges are engaged in an awful lot of public relation spin doctoring these days. You know, every college I know about has a public affairs office, and on the website of my university, you can never read any bad news. It's always the greatest accomplishments since last week. And if somebody resigns or disappears, or you can't even find it on the website.
They do disappear.
So, yeah, they do. Right. So I don't like that. I think that college presidents and should be a little more candid about what the challenges are. They're so scared of their reputation sliding, or people getting worried that the college isn't raising more money than ever, or getting better students than ever, or building more beautiful buildings than ever. I think they should be a little more honest about what the challenges are, as I think our politicians should be. So I would say a little more candor about the challenges we face, and I've only touched on a very few of them, would be in order.
All right. Professor Delbanco, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Professor Andrew Delbanco of Columbia University in conversation with Rich Fisher here on Studio Tulsa back in September. The new book from Andrew Delbanco is College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be. That book begins with an epigraph, a quotation from W.E.B. Du Bois, which goes like this: "The true college will ever have one goal, not to earn meat, but to know the end and aim of that life which meat nourishes." I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you next time on Studio Tulsa.